Hi, this is John Hartra, and welcome to episode 26 of Keep On Grooving and part 2 of our look at the people who worked with Jimmy both on stage and behind the scenes. This time we'll deal with the tour managers and his later bandmates, who oddly enough knew him from before his days in the Experience. And yes, we'll talk a little bit more about Alan too. Episode 26, Hendrix's Helpers, Part 2. Nope, couldn't come up with a better title. Sorry. With the Experience touring a lot, they needed sure hands and minds out there on the road as well as in the studio, and they ended up giving birth to a legendary figure behind the scenes. Jerry Stickles was born in 1942 up in Knowles' neck of the woods up in Kent. His parents came from the Romney Marsh and worked the farms in the area. Did they have many dealings with scarecrows? Wonder if they knew Dr. Sin. Jerry worked as a car mechanic and moonlighted as a driver for a lot of the local bands in the area. It was in that context he ran into Chas Chandler. Jimmy had just arrived and was preparing to head to Europe for some shows, but his gear was stuck at the airport and custom. Chas told him, "You get the equipment through customs, you can come along." Jerry did it and went from roadie to tour manager pretty quickly. He was there for a lot of the highlights, Monterey and Woodstock being the most prominent. There were also the lowlights. At the Experience's last appearance at the Denver Pop Festival, things got so out of hand, he got a U-Haul to practically drive up to the stage and have the guys hop into the back. At Femarn, the motorcycle gangs who took over the festival were insistent Jimmy played in the rain on Saturday night. But Jerry argued forcefully Jimmy was not going on that night. And considering he was slightly smaller than Led Zeppelin's calming force behind the scenes, Peter Grant, the gang backed off and Jimmy took the stage on Sunday. Jerry also had the unfortunate task of identifying Jimmy's body at the morgue and taking him back to Seattle for burial. Stickles managed Electric Lady Studios for a bit, but then moved to LA when he saw how big touring would mean to the music business. He started his own company and began working with more up-and-coming acts. He was working with Elton John right as he was beginning his big run of hit albums in the States. Through him, he got hooked up with an up-and-coming English act with another flamboyant leader. Roger Taylor, John Deacon, Brian May, and Freddie Mercury were starting to make waves in the English music scene, but it was through touring that Queen really made their mark and established themselves as a major force in the 70s and early 80s. It could be that working with an eclectic personality like Jimmy gave him the know-how on how to work with someone like Freddie Mercury. According to a number of people around them, Jerry was one of the few people who could get Freddie to either change his mind or not do something totally stupid. Even producer Roy Thomas Baker had trouble doing that. In the 80s, Jerry was the one to put together the Rock and Rio concert, which helped open up South America as a touring venue. He was also there for Live Aid, which revived Queen's somewhat flagging fortunes at the time and put them back on people's radar, where they remain to this day as one of the most popular bands in the world of streaming. After Mercury's passing, Jerry became a free agent of sorts and worked with the biggest names in the business and the biggest tours until the early 2000s when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He held on until just a few years back, passing away in 2019. He lived long enough to see Queen reach the big screen with Rami Malek's Oscar-winning performance as Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody. It's a shame he didn't get a chance to see Jimmy get the same treatment. Like I mentioned, we'll talk about the movies and videos in an episode sometime later next year. Now, I'd love to have done a little segment on Eric Barrett, who is sort of the other head of the Hendrix Road crew and was there for many of their more flamboyant moments. But apart from a picture with him and David Bowie and a recent shot of him and Joe Perry, there ain't a whole lot of info on the internet out there about him. I'm sure I could bug the guys over at the Hoffman boards for information, but I don't have a lot of time to go bothering them. There has to be more stuff out there in the books and such. I do have Electric Gypsy. They mentioned he was working with the Nice before joining Jimmy in 1968. He was there on September 18th and supposedly was one of the people in the cleanup crew. Going from Jimmy to Bowie to Aerosmith, there's got to be a lot more stories out there. Eric, I owe you a more comprehensive segment down the line at some point. I promise you. Interestingly, when Jimmy moved on from the Experience, he ended up relying on two guys who knew him from before he was famous. Buddy Miles had met Jimmy on the R&B circuit in, of all places, Montreal. Now, Buddy's real name was George Allen Miles. What's with all the guys with Allen as their middle names? Remember, that was Jimmy's original middle name when he was Johnny Allen. Buddy was born in Omaha, Nebraska, and got into music at an early age. He got the Buddy nickname from Buddy Rich. Not sure I can hear him do sing, sing, sing like that, but maybe if he had the shot. He did his own run on the Chitlin circuit before joining guitarist Mike Bloomfield in his band Electric Flag. That band played Monterey and brought Buddy back into Jimmy's sphere again when they both took part in the jams at Stephen Stills' house. Electric Flag broke up and Buddy started his own band, the Buddy Miles Express, which recorded two albums. Jimmy gave a poem for the first album and produced four tracks on the second. When that band broke up, he joined Jimmy and their work eventually became the band of Gypsies. We've gone over that part of Jimmy's career quite a bit, and we'll go over it again at some point once the Electric Lady Bach comes out and if we get any more Band of Gypsy studio sessions. Buddy was fired at the end of January and went off to record his own albums. From there, Miles worked consistently, but not always high in the limelight. His highlight was the early 70s, right after Jimmy died. His album, Them Changes, featured the Band of Gypsy's song, Them Changes, with help on bass from Billy Cox. It also had covers of Dreams by the Allman Brothers. Buddy would later play on the demo for Wasted Words with Greg Allman and Johnny Winter, as well as a highly praised version of Neil Young's Down by the River. Buddy's last big chart success was a top 10 live album recorded with Carlos Santana, side two of which was taken up by a track titled Freeform Funkified Filth, only in the 70s. From there, he had his ups and downs. The big downs were time in prison in the late 70s and early 80s for theft. But some good even came from this. Once released, he worked with a bunch of musicians trying to put together a kind of comeback. They recorded an album's worth of demos, but it never got released. It did make its way to some record company and advertising executives. The California Raisin Organization was looking to start a new promotional campaign based around the old Motown classic, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. They needed a singer, and based on some of the demos he cut, Buddy got the job. More people probably heard those commercials than anything he'd done since his early top 10 albums with Jimmy and Carlos. This coincided with the late 80s CD push, with Jimmy's albums getting new life in digital form. From there, Buddy worked continuously and took part in a bunch of Jimmy tribute projects, a number of them we mentioned in the tribute show, including Band of Gypsies Returns. Unfortunately, Buddy passed away in early 2008 from congestive heart failure. He was only 60 years old. Oddly enough, Jimmy's two main drummers died in 2008, Buddy in February and Mitch in November. To complete the circle, Rocky Isaac, who played on a number of Jimmy's April 1969 recordings like Crash Landing and An Early Room Full of Mirrors, passed away in July of 2020. He kind of gets a bad rap because on the tape, Jimmy's always trying to get him to play in time. But, give the guy a break. He's playing songs he didn't know with one of the greatest guitarists of all time. And he had his own style, different from Mitch's jazz bass style and Buddy's four on the floor, fat back cement mixer style. For a guy thrown in the lion's den, he did okay. Speaking of getting thrown into the lion's den, that analogy is most apropos for Jimmy's friend Billy Cox. Billy was born in West Virginia in 1941 and lived his early life around Pittsburgh. He joined the Army in 1961 and ended up at Fort Campbell the same time as Jimmy. As recounted in the 1973 movie, Billy heard him playing in the service club and liked what he heard. So he introduced himself, checked out a bass, and the two started jamming. Once their service time was over, they stayed in the area and put together a band called the King Casuals. After a couple years, Jimmy went off to do the wider Chitlin circuit in any number of R&B bands, while Billy stayed in the Nashville area and became a staple of that scene. In fact, he played a lot on their local Night Train R&B TV show. Now, if you've done a YouTube search, you may have stumbled across a clip from 1965 where Jimmy is in the backup band playing shotgun for a couple of local singers. That clip is from Night Train. I wonder if Billy helped him get the gig. Billy also did some songwriting, and Jimmy played on a session for his song I'm So Glad that appeared on West Coast Seattle Boy. Jimmy even called Billy when he was getting ready to go to London, but Cox was a little down on his luck at that point and had no money to get to New York. I mean, he literally had three broken guitar strings. Well, bass strings in this case. But Jimmy needed his old friend once again when the experience fell apart. In mid-1969, Billy was able to get to New York and began to play with Jimmy on informal recording sessions with both Mitch Mitchell and Buddy Miles. He played with Jimmy's extended band, Gypsy Suns and Rainbows, at Woodstock. It was around that time he started to notice things were getting a little strange. While they were at a rented house in Shokan, New York, he noticed guys hanging around out in the middle of nowhere. There were even reports of gunshots going off. They were trying to put together a different sound, but that whole situation made it difficult. Getting three or four guys on the same page doing a song is tough enough. Try getting six of them all going in the same direction. Maybe it was a little lucky in that sense that the band took the stage early Monday morning when the crowd of hundreds of thousands shrunk down to about 25,000 or so. There's a quote Billy said in one of the shows or movies where they had an interview with him that typifies his playing style. When Jimmy started the Star Spangled Banner, he started to play along with him and Mitch. Then as the song progressed, he goes, "I kind of stepped back and let me see where he was going with this." He let Jimmy do what he did, and when the guitarist kicked into Purple Haze, he was able to come right back in. After Gypsy Suns and Rainbows broke apart, Billy went back to Nashville. But Jimmy called him up and asked him to come back and work on what would become the Band of Gypsies. When he returned, Jimmy and Buddy were working with Alan Douglas. We'll talk about him more in a bit. As well as his partner, Stefan Bright. Bright immediately disliked Billy because he wanted Buddy's bassist, Billy Rich, to be in the band. Now, again, no slight to Billy Rich, but pardon me if I'm wrong, Sandy. If Jimmy wanted Billy Cox, what effing business do you have telling him you wanted somebody else? Billy Cox returned the favor in spades. "I hated that guy with a passion," he often said. So needless to say, the sessions didn't go well. The only thing of lasting merit was the backing track for Roomful of Mirrors, and as we've stated in the past, Jimmy had a problem with the way the drums were recorded. Why he didn't just have Buddy redo them a month or two later, we'll never know. So in November, Billy left again. Then Douglas and Bright left, and Jimmy was able to talk Billy into coming back again. He stayed until the MSG show and then left again. After the reuniting of the experience didn't come off, Jimmy called, guess what, again. It took a little longer to get Billy to come back, but he finally did. Musically, things finally seemed to be moving towards a definite conclusion. A lot of the songs Jimmy had been working on for months, or in the case of Angel, years, began to take shape, first at the record plant, then at Electric Lady. Billy's contributions were an integral part of those songs. Billy said, "You know, we didn't play by notes on a music stand, you know, we played by feel." Cox has said he helped Jimmy develop a lot of the songs, and Hendrix was going to give him credit. But after he died, that never came off. Plus, at the time, he was recovering from the breakdown he had during the European tour, so he was seemingly out of the picture once and for all. Thankfully for Billy, he did recover and took part in the Nashville music scene once more as a session player. Once the 80s and 90s came around and interest in Jimmy's music continued to prosper, he did many tribute shows and collaborated on the Sessions and Ultimate Hendrix books in the 2000s. He's been a staple on the Experience Hendrix tribute shows and is in several halls of fame for his work with Jimmy and others. Not bad for a guy with three broken strings when Jimmy called the first time. As I mentioned in an earlier episode, I got a chance to meet Billy and Eddie Kramer at Virgin Music in Times Square when the Voodoo Child compilation was released. He was as genuine and as straightforward as you can see in the interviews with him. Some people kind of bust his chops for leaving Jimmy the number of times he did. The way I see it, he was a regular guy walking into a hurricane. The sane thing to do is walk away if it gets too dangerous and chaotic, which is what he did. But his friend was in trouble, so he was there for him until literally he couldn't do it anymore. But all these years later, he's never dumped on him and never written a tell-all book. He's an all-around stand-up guy, and both personally and musically, Jimmy was lucky to have him. And guess who just had a birthday week and a half ago? Yep, Billy Cox just turned 81. Happy birthday, Billy. Hope you had a great day. Thanks for all the great music you've given us over the years. Before moving on to the last person I want to talk about, I just want to quick give little recaps on the other three members of the Woodstock band. Like Billy, Larry Lee knew Jimmy from back in his Chitlin' Circuit days. He'd been serving in Vietnam and had been home just for a couple of weeks when Jimmy called and asked him to play Woodstock the next week. Larry came with his old Gibson guitar, which is great for R&B, but maybe not quite what Jimmy's music needed. He did what he could and even got a chance to sing a few numbers himself, including his own Mastermind. Because his songs have been excluded from the Woodstock releases, they've gotten the reputation that they're unreleasable. They may not be top-notch R&B, but they're perfectly fine. The other issue was the tuning on Larry's guitar. Some say it's just out of tune. I think it may have been tuned to the wrong key. Either way, some of it didn't sound so great. In the studio sessions, however, Larry's guitar provided a great counterpoint to Jimmy, especially on the original longer versions of Isabella and the unedited Easy Blues. But eventually, Larry realized there could only be one guitar player in the band and went back to Nashville. He didn't stay idle for long. He ended up joining Al Green's band, eventually becoming music director for a number of years. He was a regular of the Nashville music scene for decades, but unfortunately succumbed to cancer in 2007. Percussionist Juma Sultan joined up with Jimmy and stuck around a bit after the Woodstock band broke up. He played with Jimmy, Billy, and Mitch on Hendrix's second appearance on the Dick Cavett Show, doing a medley of Isabella and Machine Gun. He returned to do percussions on quite a number of the Electric Lady recordings. After Jimmy's death, he continued with music, recording numerous avant-garde jazz performances on both tape and film. Juma turned 80 this year, so happy birthday, Mr. Sultan. The other percussionist, Geraldo Jerry Velez, also ended up having a long career. And I actually saw one of his concerts before I ever really paid attention to Jimmy. Back in the late 70s and early 80s in the New York area, there was a pay TV service called Wameka Home Theater, or WHT. It broadcast a scrambled signal over Channel 68 in Newark, and you get a decoder box to unscramble it and watch movies and such. Some areas in New Jersey, like ours at the time, didn't have widespread cable access, so this was the alternative to that. Along with the kind of movies you'd see on HBO and Showtime, they played some Yankees and Rangers games and played a number of obscure concerts. One of them was for the band Spira Gyra. They were a jazz outfit, and their music was a little out there. Years later, I found that one of the percussionists was Jerry Velez. He was with Spira Gyra from the late 70s through the mid-80s. Jerry is thankfully also still with us, so keep on conging, Jerry. The last person we'll talk about today is Alan Douglas. He was born in 1931 in Massachusetts. He has a brother, Jerry, who was born a year later. USOP fans may recognize him from The Young and the Restless. Alan joined United Artists Records in 1962, taking over the jazz division. He was there for a number of years and put together some unique albums, such as getting Duke Ellington and Charles Mingus in one session. He left United Artists and began his own label, Douglas Records. One of its first releases was a compilation of recordings of late comedian Lenny Bruce entitled Essential Lenny Bruce. He met Jimmy in late 1969 and began to suggest he move towards different types of music. He was the one who helped put together the Almost session between Jimmy, Miles Davis, and Tony Williams, and maybe Paul McCartney if one telegram is to be believed. He also introduced Jimmy to the proto-rap world with The Last Poets, the fruits of which were Doriella Duffontaine, which didn't see release until the 1980s. He also put together the band's The Gypsies concerts with Bill Graham, but when it came to actual recording, well, we just talked about that with Billy Cox. Allen wasn't also thrilled with Jimmy's work ethic to some extent, even though he was part of that same partying world. Despite all that, the two remained friends and hung around together quite a bit in 1970. Allen was one of those who saw Jimmy in the days before he died. Jimmy even drove him to Heathrow to go back to New York. Supposedly, one of the things Allen was supposed to do was go to Mo Austin and tell him Hendrix would get reprised the double album and would be looking for new management. But the events of the next day rendered all that moot. Allen was at the funeral and did make a brief appearance in the 1973 film talking about how they scored drugs. As I said when I mentioned this earlier, it was the 60s. Again, that would appear to have been the last he'd have to do with Hendrix, but that would soon change. In 1974, Douglas managed to get the job of putting together something out of the mass of tapes left behind. He started slowly with a radio station promo of a couple of Christmas-related songs. This was followed in 1975 by Crash Landing, the album where tapes of unfinished Hendrix songs were supplemented by contemporary overdubs by studio musicians. This partially led to Douglas getting co-writing credit on all but the three songs that had previously appeared on album before in different forms, which does bring up the whole Come Down Hard on Me question, but water under the bridge at this point. We've gone over his curation of the catalog from 1975 to 1995. No need to rehash it here. Once he left the Hendrix curator position in the mid-90s, he basically kept a low profile. He did put out a book on Hendrix writings and was supposedly working on a film when he had a fall in June 2014 and passed away from the complications. He was certainly a controversial figure, but his contributions were neither all good nor all bad. The mindset in 1975 was far different than the one that started in the mid-80s with the CD era. He was just trying to put together a coherent album that sounded relevant to the era. He did have a tough task, figuring out what to put out that would catch a listener's ear. He definitely struggled at times, but we're now able to put the pieces in place thanks to some of what he did. You know, let's put out the original versions of the songs on the 1975 albums. Though, Experience Hendrix messed up Crash Landing themselves as well. Let's do a fuller Winterland collection. Let's do a complete BBC collection. Like I've said, that 1995 interview for Voodoo Soup left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, my own included. I can now look at Voodoo Soup as a decent collection of songs that were unnecessarily altered. I can use a few more songs to be a fully satisfying experience. I got a lot bigger than I intended. When I wanted to do 10 people, what I ended up doing, like 20 or so? Next time, it'll be back to new music. Well, a new release, anyway. The April 26, 1969 concert from the LA Forum is being reissued next month for the first time with all the songs in one place, though not quite complete. We'll compare it to the Lifelines version as well as to the show the next day up in Oakland, which was the first Dagger release, as well as how this whole week was pivotal to Jimmy's future. That'll be coming Thanksgiving weekend, right around Jimmy's birthday. Please hit the subscribe button if you like what you're hearing. I'm John Hartshorn. Thanks for listening.